Welcome. Welcome to everyone listening all around the world, all across the United States. We're coming to you live from that depository of lost history and knowledge, which is the Coast to Coast AM studios right here in Los Angeles, California. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, sitting in for George Norrie on this Friday evening and heading into the early morning hours of Saturday. And you know the drill, man. Since it's Friday, that means open lines. And my guest tonight is Randall Carlson. And I can't wait for the calls that are guaranteed to come in after you get to sit and listen to our conversation. But in our quest for the truth, for knowledge and history, we have a group of researchers and authors out there that have brought forth and brought us some great work. And of course, you have Hancock, you've got Bovall, Schock, West, Collins, Forrester, just to name a few. You know who I'm talking about. But then you have the researcher's researcher, the one that everyone else turns to, the one that they depend on, the secret weapon. And that guy at the center of it all is Randall Carlson. Although this is Randall's first time on Coast to Coast, he's been researching lost history, sacred geometry, architecture, and the mysteries for over 40 years. And his work is often quoted. And I can't tell you how many private conversations I've had with different researchers sitting in a dark bar somewhere. And I've heard that line, well, you know, Randall Carlson says, seriously. One of the great things about our world today is our access to information. But with it comes a price. Every day that passes and we move forward, we find out more and more, don't we? And that the world, us, and our history as it has been fed to us just doesn't make any sense. And sure, it's easy to just go on with our lives every single day and not concern ourselves with questioning the man, academia, the so-called professionals. And I say that with air quotes. That's what the man would want. That's what they want to do. But why hide the past? Why do they want to do this? After all, it belongs to us, right? So we have a choice, my friends. We can keep our heads in the sand, we can ignore our past, or we can find the answers that we seek. Who are we? And how did we get here? It's the fundamental question, isn't it? And tonight, it's time to fill the gaps. And there's only one man to ask and find out the who, what, when, and why. And that's Randall Carlson. You can follow me right now on Twitter at JChurchRadio. That's what you want to do. You do know the drill. Twitter is always live to my left. Any questions or comments, you can post them there. And maybe, if you get lucky, your tweet will get read on the air. Do enjoy the bumper music tonight. I think it's the best yet. You know, Dan says the judge is out on that, but we'll find out. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. I'll be right back with my guest, Randall Carlson. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, tonight sitting in for George. He and Tommy are up north at a UFO conference, and they're up there having a good time, but spoke to him before the show tonight, and he says hello to all of you and the Coast Insiders. Randall Carlson. He is a master builder, an architectural designer, teacher, geometrician, geomythologist, geological explorer, and renegade scholar. He has four decades of study, research, and exploration into the interference between ancient mysteries and modern science. He's been active as a Freemason for over 40 years and is a past master of one of the oldest and largest Masonic lodges in Georgia. Randall has organized several dozen field expeditions documenting evidence for catastrophic earth change, and his work incorporates ancient mythology, astronomy, earth science, paleontology, symbolism, sacred geometry, and architecture, and all of those other arcane and scientific traditions. For over 25 years, he has presented classes, lectures, and multimedia programs synthesizing this information for students of the mysteries. Randall interprets the hidden meaning of the great masterpieces of mystical architecture, esoteric and occult ritual, and its symbolism. I would like to welcome, for the first time to Coast AM, Randall Carlson. Randall, good evening.
Well, good evening to you, Jimmy.
Randall, what took you so long?
That's a good question. I've been late to the party more than once.
I know you caught my intro for you tonight, but it's really playing out to be true in that you are now surfacing as one of the guys that is, providing that knowledge to so many others and your friends out there. And you've been like that go-to guy for so long. But with that comes responsibility, my friend. Do you feel that pressure now that you are the Randall Carlson, right? Everybody's heard about you, but now you are here. Is that pressure?
It's kind of scary, actually. I've always enjoyed my anonymity.
And right.
That's kind of how I've managed to do a lot of what I do, by kind of staying out of the limelight and kind of, off on the side doing my thing. And then, the last year or two, I get on the airplane, I get recognized, I walk down the street or go into the grocery store, and, which is very cool to have somebody come up to me and go, "Hey, man, I saw you yesterday on whatever." And
right.
I've been looking at you. Which is, that's a good thing. I mean, it's a balancing act. It's, knowing that you're kind of inspiring people to think about things that they might have not thought about, or putting them onto some ideas that stimulate them. And then on the other hand, it's like, gosh, am I about to climb on the whirlwind here, or what's going to happen?
Well, and then there's the other part of it, right? You always hear from comedians when they meet somebody on the street and they come up and they go, "Tell me something funny. Tell me a joke," right? And with you, it must be the same thing, except for you have to say something smart, right?
Well, at least fake it.
Right. That's exactly it. And now that does bear responsibility. Are you careful with your words, not only on Coast to Coast, but when you meet somebody that has a question, they're going to listen to you now. You're that guy. So do you choose your words differently?
Yeah, it depends on the person. I mean, if it's a one-on-one, if it's an individual, somebody that I know or a stranger that, saw something and has a question, for one thing, it might be, how much background do they have? Do they even have a context for making sense of any answer that I would give them? Or, if it's somebody, because of that, I've actually made several good friends here now in the last couple of years. One of my last field trips, I had a couple of people that I kind of met that way, who came along on the field trip and were great, contributed a lot, helped to pull off the expedition successfully. And so, there's definitely an upside. I mean, I'm starting to meet quite a few people that have been thinking along these lines and thinking that there might be a pathway ahead of us that, that this information may have implications regarding, and, where we go from here and how we build a successful civilization in the next century or two. I think this information kind of does dovetail into some of those kind of projections, and that was my motivation, a lot of my motivation all along, was thinking in terms of, well, what do we, the human species, really need to know in order to, survive on this planet successfully? Not just survive like in a brute stone age existence, but how to survive prosperously and successfully and pull it off here on this planet. So that's been a big part of my motivation, and figuring that sooner or later, I'd start putting it out there, but it's been an evolutionary process. It's been in gestation for a long time. A lot of information that I've worked to pull together and tried to make sense out of. And just when I think, hey, I might be close to having this figured out, then I realize, no, not really. No, there's a whole lot more to this whole thing here of, the human presence on Earth and where we came from and what our real history is and where we might be going. And is it an accident? Is it a program? Is it some kind of a teleological mystery that we're involved in? And then you turn to history and you realize, like you were saying in the introduction, there is a lot of omissions, a lot of inconsistencies, a lot of contradictions in the conventional models of history that we've been fed. And, you know, this is what, like that, the list of researchers that you mentioned, you know, that's what they're all been busy with, kind of like looking at those, you know, looking between the cracks in the edifice of our models of civilization on this planet, and realizing that there are a lot of cracks, and that when you do peer through the cracks, there's interesting things that begin to show up.
With Orthodox academia, well, let's just say the man, because it goes with governments and institutions and professionals, yeah, and so forth. But why suppress this information? It's the history belongs to us. The gaps are there. Why suppress this and keep it from us?
Well, I think clearly we get hierarchies of power that get entrenched, and they usually will conform themselves to some extent to what people believe. If people have a certain view of history and how things came to be the way they are now, and there are, like I said, political institutions, I think, that would have a vested interest in keeping certain models of history and civilization intact. The thing that comes to my mind right now is the idea that, human beings are now the dominant force for global change, and in a sense, I agree with if we look at the short term. Right now, humans are a tremendous force for planetary change. We're modifying all kinds of things. If, however, we look at the big picture, our imprint on the planet could pale into insignificance pretty readily. And one of the important things that I think that comes out of this kind of information in this research is that there are two modes of planetary change. There's the mode that essentially saw the rise of modern civilization, the last 4,000 years, roughly 5,000 years. And this is a mode where basically the parameters of change are within relatively narrow limits. But if we go back farther than that, we realize that the amplitude of change has had wild, very large swings in it. And the interesting thing is it seems to be sort of quasi-periodic. There seems to be a sort of a tempo. And what we see is that the pace of normal, what we think of as normal change, what in the geological sense would be described as uniform change or gradualistic change,
right,
is punctuated, to use Stephen Jay Gould's term, by these discontinuities, these event nodes, as I kind of think of them. And it's during these points of discontinuity, these short-term periods of concentrated change, where really all of the action is. And this is where most of the great global changes and planetary changes occur, is during these short-term intervals of compressed change. And then once that's over, you have an extended period where you would have a more regular climate, a regular environment, such as we have experienced within the last, like I said, 4,000 years, 5,000 years, since the rise of history in the, like, Fertile Crescent, where you had the emergence of the Nile civilization between 4,500 and 5,000 years ago. You had the emergence in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley of the Sumerians. You had the emergence in the Indus Valley of that civilization. All roughly, you know, within a century or two of each other, we begin to really see the establishment of these cultures. If we go back a little further into the past, we discovered that there was some major blips in the continuity of global change that just preceded the rise of modern history.
And
if we go back even further, we discover that there are some major blips in global history, global in planetary change, going back, you know, 12,000 to 13,000 years ago. So, yes, I think that we're beginning to discover that there is sort of a cosmic or geological determinism to the rise and fall of civilization. And when we look at this and begin to understand how sweeping and intense some of the changes have been on this planet, literally, I would think of it almost like as a remodeling of the entire planetary surface during some of these episodes, one can begin to understand why the activities of humans 15 or 20 or 30,000 years ago, when there were modern humans, why those activities would essentially be missing from the record, simply because the degree of change has been so extreme in some of these events that whatever world existed before the onset of these changes, in the aftermath, it was gone.
So you're suggesting that, and I want to fully understand this, some of it is cyclical and natural, contained here on Earth. Some of it could be cosmic bound, right? Some kind of meteor effect. Some could be the sun going through cycles, and some of it is just caused by us, and therefore it isn't consistent, but some of it is and cyclical. Am I understanding you correctly?
I think that would be a fair interpretation. And the idea here was that I was essentially within these periods of, I would say, more gradualistic change, such that we've been in for the last 4,000 years, these periods of uniform change.
Mm-hmm.
Our activity is going to stand out quite prominently, much more prominently than it would looking at the long-term record. Because, you know, when we go back 12,000 to 13 to 15,000 years ago, we're basically in the end of the last great ice age. And at the what they call the late glacial maximum period, which was 17 to 20,000 years ago,
right,
there was an enormous mass of ice covering better than half of North America. I mean, you got to think of half of North America, all of Canada, having an environment and a climate whose closest modern analog is the South Pole. Literally, you know,
right,
you have
right.
this massive sheet of ice that might have been up to 2 miles thick in its center, and reaching from the Atlantic to the Pacific Oceans, from the northern United States up to the Arctic Circle. And because of this huge mass of ice, sea levels worldwide had dropped some 400 feet. And in that dropping, coastlines migrated seaward and exposed several million square miles of land that is now drowned under hundreds of feet of ocean water. And during the Ice Age, any kind of evolved culture or society or civilization at all would probably begin on the coastlines of the Earth, just because that would have been the benign place to live during those times.
Right.
And, of course, the point being is that they're all underwater now. The other place, and when we look at the rise of modern civilization, we see that exactly, that cities, urban centers begin to be established along coastlines. At the mouths of rivers was a quite frequent place. We begin to see the first great urban centers appearing. And when you realize that the transference of all of this ice back into the ocean basins as a result of the great melting that occurred, it pretty much overwhelmed most of the river valleys of the northern hemisphere, for sure. And there's a lot of evidence that the southern hemisphere, at least in South America, also experienced the same thing. And this overwhelming of the river valleys clearly would have flushed out anything that was there.
We've got about 1 minute before we hit a break, so I'm going to ask you quickly, inside of that 5,000-year window from here going back 5,000 years, we've had the rise and decline of so many civilizations around the world. And with that, a rise of intelligence and invention, too, as well. Were each one of those on a micro scale affected by climate change, too, as well, with that degradation?
Oh, I think so. I think natural global change. And one of the things we could explore as a possibility, and I think this is, I'm not saying this is determined or anything, but a possibility is that the events that occurred that jerked this planet out of the depths of the Ice Age were so extreme that I'm sure that there were thousands of years of what you would think of as aftershocks to that, as the planet adjusted to this new regimen, which it certainly did. I mean, there were definitely tectonic and volcanic consequences to this tremendous mass transfer that occurred on the surface of the Earth. And just like with any seismic event, there's quite frequent that there's not only foreshocks, there are aftershocks as the plates begin to adjust to this new balance of things. And so I think that a lot of the aftershocks that occurred in this transition out of the Ice Age and might still, some of the stuff that's going on today, seismically, may still be echoes of that event from 13,000 years ago, because it was that powerful.
Our guest tonight, Randall Carlson. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, sitting in for George Norrie. Friday night, open lines, and Randall, all in one night. We'll be right back. All right, you like that? Home by the Sea, get it? Is there a pattern here with the music tonight? You can thank Randall for that one. Are you a Coast Insider? Well, I'm your host, Jimmy Church, and I'm a Coast Insider. This Tuesday, March 28th, I'm going to be hanging out with all of you Coast Insiders for a little chat session. Really looking forward to that, so I'll see you this Tuesday. Tonight, my guest, Randall Carlson. This is what we're doing tonight, everybody, so buckle up. We're going to cover lost and hidden history, lost civilizations, technology, their connections to catastrophic events, ancient mythology, modern science, and of course, we got to throw in some academia. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. More with Randall right after this short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, for tonight. I'm sitting in for George. He and Tommy are up north at a convention. And you can follow me on Twitter right now, at JChurchRadio. Okay, our guest tonight is Randall Carlson. And any questions or comments during the show tonight, post it there. If it's good, I'll read it on the air. Just like this one, Randall. This comes in from Genevieve. And she says, if there were large populations in previous civilizations, where did the buildings go? And my answer to that, I'm going to hand this off to you, but my answer is, well, we've got Göbekli Tepe, don't we? And so I'm going to take this question a step further for you, Randall. How many other Göbekli Tepes do you think are out there just waiting to be discovered?
Well, would like to speculate that there's probably dozens, but we'll have to see on that. You know, as far as buildings being preserved and the infrastructure of a civilization, what you find with Göbekli Tepe is that it was buried. And that's why we know about it today, is because it's been preserved by being buried. And that was the point I was trying to make in the first part of our discussion, was the extreme nature of these changes would easily erase anything, any handiwork of humans.
Quickly.
And I mean, yeah, very effectively.
Right.
You know, in my research, my geomorphic research, you know, when you're standing there, for example, looking into an awning, a yawning chasm that's 1,000 feet deep and 5 miles wide, and you realize that canyon you're looking at wasn't created over millions of years, but perhaps days.
And
you're beginning to understand it.
Yes.
Yeah, I get it now. No matter what was here before, it's gone. I mean, think about this, Jimmy. If you've got a force capable of excavating and removing 1,000 feet of bedrock, what was on the top of the surface of that ground before these events is anybody's question. We also know that at the same time, the same interval when these changes were occurring on this scale, at the end of the last ice age, what a geologist would call the Pleistocene-Holocene transition, there was also a great mass extinction event. These events were so severe that they dramatically affected the large animals of the earth, and there were many, many species that went extinct within this short window of time that coincides exactly with these global upheavals that jerked the planet out of the ice age. And, you know, one of the things that has been sort of an entrenched idea for about a half a century now is that the megafauna disappeared because they were hunted to extinction by predatory Paleo-Indians. Yet, as anthropological models have emerged, that's totally inconsistent with the idea that these people, small bands of Paleo-Indian nomadic hunters who also, you know, hunted small game, also foraged, also ate a lot of fish and seafood and so on, could have exterminated not only 10 or 12 million mammoths from the earth, but about another 100 species of megafauna as well. I'm finding it's much more plausible, and now I've felt for many years it's more plausible that humans were affected almost as profoundly as the megafauna. And a lot of interesting research has come out in the last decade or so.
Oh, I think we lost Randall. We lost Randall. Okay, we'll get back to him in just a second. But one of the points, as soon as I bring Randall back, that we need to explore, and I often wonder, in the last 2,000 years or 5,000 years, or we look at 2,000 years to today, or just the last 100 years from 1900 to 2017, how rapidly we progressed from seemingly nothing to ultimately everything, right? 5,000 years ago, we're nomadic. We are in the Stone Age, and we turn around in 5,000 years, and here we are today visiting the stars. And we have Randall back now. Let's go ahead and lock him down, and I'll bring him in right now. Randall.
I'm here.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up, that's strange. See, the man is listening. I'm telling you, the man wants to suppress, Randall. Is this, if we look at the last 5,000 years, right, how rapidly we progressed from, you know, basically being nomadic in Stone Age to today, where we're visiting our moons and Mars and sending probes out of the solar system. That is a pretty rapid rise from Stone Age to today. And if we look at the last 100 years, you know, go back, we barely had electricity in 1900, right? Barely.
Right.
In the last 100 years, we're planning manned missions to Mars, like it's just the next thing to do because we can. If we take that, how many times could civilization have done that same progression in the last 100,000 years or 200,000 years, and that we just don't know about it? You know, another event came in and wiped them out, and we had to start over again. Is there evidence of that?
Well, the evidence we have basically suggests that in the last 100 to 200,000 years, somewhere within that interval is when modern man appeared upon the Earth, at least based upon the earliest fossil evidence of modern humans. I think fossil evidence of what appear to be, in every respect, modern humans is now going back to 150 to 180,000 years.
Right.
So when you're talking about, 180,000 years, that's, what's a generation? Say 25 years? That's 7,000-something generations of people that could have, of modern humans that could have occupied this Earth. And, in effect, it's kind of a mystery to say, well, how come all of a sudden within the last few hundred years we just suddenly exponentially started progressing like we have? Well, at least that's partially explicable when you look at the record of global change and you realize that even in the last 5,000 years, there have been major upheavals within the natural order, within the balance of nature, that have profoundly affected emerging human cultures. I mean, if the Mediterranean civilization, what they refer to as the Bronze Age collapse, which occurred, between 1300 and 1500 BC, that saw the sudden disappearance of all of the cultures around the Mediterranean. There's evidence that there was possibly a cosmic event associated with that. Then we have the onset of the Dark Ages between about 536 and 544 AD, and that also involved extreme environmental changes. There's evidence, again, of possibly incursions of cosmic material into the terrestrial biosphere, not only in the terms of cosmic dust, but perhaps several impacts. There's evidence of an impact perhaps off the coast of Norway. There's an evidence, potential evidence, not proven yet, but has all the earmarks of an impact event off the coast of New Zealand that dates to right in that interval. It also appears that there may have been episodes of volcanic eruption, and taken together, these events would have had a powerful effect on the biosphere. And what we see is that, basically over a period of a couple hundred years, the Roman Empire collapsed. Then between 536 and 544 AD, we see that there's a major darkening, literally, of the Northern Hemisphere, which has been recorded in many historical annals. I mean, literally talking about days on end, weeks on end, where people didn't see the sun, never came out. It was like dusk all day long. And then there was a period right after 536 when, dendrochronologists who look at tree rings have studied extensively into this period and discovered that for about a decade, immediate post 536 AD, forest growth in the northern hemisphere almost came to a halt, which clearly indicates that something really stressful was going on. In that period of time, we see that in Europe, where we have a record of it, there was a repeated series of agricultural collapses. And these agricultural collapses were then followed by famine. When you have famine, people get weak. Their immune systems become depressed, and they now become susceptible to epidemic diseases. And that's exactly what we see happen here at 542 AD, what is called the Justinian Plague, essentially wiped out a third the population of Europe. In some places, it was a half and three quarters of the population was basically gone. And it took 3 centuries or so to recover from that.
Was that a cosmic event, too? I always associated that period was the fall of the Roman Empire, right, and the retreat.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And certainly there is a correlation between what is happening sociologically and what is happening in terms of the environment. Just in the same way, similar, I think, maybe on a smaller scale, we see parallel to the Depression taking place at the same time as the Dust Bowl back in the 1930s. Where you have this kind of simultaneous, cultural phenomena, where you have some perturbation in the culture at the same time you're having a perturbation in the natural order of things, and we certainly see this back in that period of the onset of the Dark Ages, and so this would have been a major contributing factor. And if cultures had not become, see, this is part of maybe one of the other lessons to be gleaned from this. If cultures get too preoccupied with their own endeavors to the point where they're ignoring what's going on in the world around them, they become much more vulnerable. And I think this is a case in point would be like what happened with the colonists in Greenland, who, you know, there are very interesting accounts of what happened to that, because there you see a microcosmic example of a cultural collapse brought on by global change, because you had let's put it in context. The Dark Ages was followed by the Medieval Warm Period. The Medieval Warm Period was a time where many studies actually suggest that it was a degree, 2 degrees warmer than it is now, believe it or not. Yes, there are many studies that show that. And
that's incredible. That's incredible.
That's when you had the Scandinavians colonizing Greenland and farming up on the west coast of Greenland, where now it's almost perennial permafrost.
Right.
And they had basically throughout the entire medieval warm period, they were successfully living there, except the changes that finally brought the curtain down on their experiment there, their cultural experiment in Greenland, was giving indications. You know, there were signs and premonitions that they essentially ignored until it was too late, because with the onset of the medieval warm period, sea ice had extended far to the north, and that opened up the sea lanes between northern Europe and Iceland and between Iceland and Greenland, and that's how they were able to actually sail there. Well, with the onset of the Little Ice Age, what happened was the medieval warm period comes to an end. The ice began to move south again. It encroached, and it closed up the sea lanes. And once those sea lanes got closed up, the Greenland colonists were cut off from the rest of Europe, and they went extinct. And what we see there is a cultural extinction. It has a lot of parallels, I think, to a biological extinction event. Both, in effect, brought on by changes within the existing order of things to which they have become adapted, to the point where they're not able to adjust their orientation and they succumb to the changes. And this is, you know, when the medieval warm period came on, you know, what we see is that population studies show that there was a population explosion during the medieval warm period because, for one thing, the growing season increased by 4 to 6 weeks in the northern hemisphere over what it had been during the Dark Ages. The latitude at which agriculture could be viably practiced shifted 300-500 miles to the north. This opened up a whole lot of territory to food production that had previously, for the previous 300 or 400 years, had been inaccessible. The altitude at which farming could be conducted rose by hundreds of feet, which again made much more area available for for food growth. With the increase in temperature, the increase in availability of food, what you had was we see the beginnings that we see population expansion, we see the expansion of urban centers, we see the establishment of trade networks, we see the increase in wealth. After about a century and a half of this is when we see the birth of the great Gothic building enterprise, which is one of the great architectural phenomena in the history of humans on this planet, when they built the great Gothic cathedrals. And what we see is that during a period of, really only about 20 or 25 years, within one generation, we see the commencement of approximately 80 of these giant cathedrals and about 500 of the lesser abbeys, but all within this Gothic style, with this, which was a completely new, almost unprecedented style.
And where did the construction? And through this period, let me. I'm going to be rude for a second, but sure. The that was also timed with the rise of alchemy and some of the other mystery school sciences that were going on. That was also incorporated into this architecture. And it showed this rise in math, geometry, engineering to construct these cathedrals coming straight out of the Dark Ages. Intelligence rose on a magnitude, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And but I think here's where it gets interesting. If you really begin to probe into some of the intricacies of historical progression, what you begin to see is that it does appear that there were certain venues that existed primarily for the preservation and transmission of knowledge and information. If we go back, say, to the in the wake of the Bronze Age collapse, what we see is the rise of a group called the Dionysian Artificers, often been associated with the building of King Solomon's Temple, because, you know, that's an interesting story in that what you had was the Babylonians and the not the Babylonians, but the Tyrians and the Jews collaborating on this project that was totally symbolical. When you look at the descriptions of King Solomon's Temple and all of that, it is a repository of information about sacred geometry. This was followed by maybe an 800-year period where this group called the Dionysian Artificers were primarily building all of the sacred structures in the Middle East. And then when Greece gave way to Rome, the rise of Rome, a lot of that information got transferred over to this group called the Roman Collegium. And the Roman Collegium built most of the Roman temples and the bathhouses and things like that. And then with the collapse of Rome, we see that it appears that the transmission of information went to this group called the Comachines, who lived on an island in the Lake Como in Italy. And then once the environment changed, became conducive, I think this information was brought out. And like I said, what happened was we had a period of a century of this warmth, a century and a half. European society grew immensely in wealth, and you now had basically the wealth and the means to undertake an enterprise like the Gothic.
Well, hold on right there, Randall. We got to take a break. We'll pick up right there when we come back. Our guest tonight, Randall Carlson. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back.